I think at the end of the day, you know, they've cherry-picked the stores that they want, and they've renegotiated the terms on those stores. So it'll be a very different business to what it was prior to administration.
A filmmaker is believed to have frozen to death as he made a documentary about sleeping rough on the streets. 26-year-old Lee Halpin was found dead in a derelict building in Newcastle. He'd planned to spend a week living on the streets of the city. The cause of his death hasn't yet been confirmed. A scathing report into problems at the top of collapsed bank HBOS says there were catastrophic failures of management. The Banking Standards Commission says Sir James Crosby, Andy Hornby and Lord Stevenson should be banned from ever working in the city again. One of the three men, Sir James Crosby, has resigned from his current city position. City analyst David Buick says the bosses were just not up to the job.
The problem was that they had no credit control. And because the management was wholly inadequate, none of them should ever have been appointed to those jobs. We ended up in this horrendous mess.
That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gove.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You know, there must be an awful lot of people in this world who need love and affection, because the signs of this are all around us. For example, I heard not too long ago that some 40 million women watch the soap opera programs every day. I don't know whether this figure is true. I sort of question all of these figures. But at least there's a lot of women that watch these regularly, sort of absorbing love through osmosis. And men read an awful lot of sexy magazines. Men, of course, wouldn't dare read a love story. Men have to read sexy magazines. But at the basis of this, what we're all searching for, I think, is someone to love and someone who loves us.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
Indian land! You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
As I said in Zambia, a lot of the times always there was the need and the recognition was white. The attitude was, hey, well, you know, of course, they're crazy, you know, she's crazy, one of them is crazy and the other one's black. But we were a little outside the pale.
What happened in the parties you went to, black parties? How were they different from going to the bar?
Oh, honey. First of all, they had good food. First of all, and you have to remember, now we are all of us, we're strong, healthy women, right? And we like to eat. That's what started. But the parties, white women's parties, never had food. They had real potato chips, but they had, you know, little dip.
And these parties were really into martinis and cafes.
That's right. And cream
wine,
cheese,
cheese and dips.
Well, black parties always had food.
And
that, in Queens, the parties that I went to were given by a group, again, a group of black lesbians, black gay girls, who were a little older than the group I was running with, who had cars, right, and drove around, and who were like performers. Some of them weren't talking bad, some of them were, you know, different. They were professional women. Semi-professional women. They were by and large old and they had a life. They used to give these parties and I met one of them and then, you know, my friends and I used to go.
But then I occasionally came to some dog parties downtown, which were, you know, predominantly white, and I might very well be the token, second token, third token. All of them get beyond third token, it was okay.
And they always looked pretty.
And they talked, they didn't move.
And
they
went
sat thing. Around and talked. And all you would hear was, but there was no music and nobody moved, you know? See, I came out of a very political family. Struggle was discussed at the dinner table. You know, our oppression and our freedom was discussed every night at the dinner table. So it was never an issue of me or when did I start struggling. I struggle against anything. I was one of those people, if a cop is giving somebody a ticket, and I know they not, you know, they wrong, I was the person out there screaming and yelling.
In other words, we need, as the movement encourages you or me or Von, to define ourselves, we deal with our similarities, and then we must deal with our differences and the differences that are not being dealt with or provided for. Now, once we deal with those differences that aren't being provided for, we do it in a context that says, hey, then we can use these differences without, we don't have to eradicate them, we don't have to, you know, wipe them out. We also don't have to remain with them. There is a topological picture, and that's how I see it. In other words, I'm talking about the creative use of difference.
Intelligent radio.
Internet radio for smarter original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the fourth world from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News Thought and Analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, neo-fascist, and neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. I wish peace to the gods and earths and love and solidarity to the entire original family at this time of strife and struggle. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. It happened. It's all over the news. Margaret Thatcher, quote-unquote, the Iron Lady, has passed. Okay, we've all been saying, too, just about all morning, all afternoon, over here. And I am joined with our engineer for this evening and executive producer, Guadalupe Morales. You know, we've been talking about this all day because it's all over the news today that Margaret Thatcher has passed. Okay. So, you know, what does this mean? Well, what did it mean when Ronald Reagan passed? You know, it really didn't mean anything. He did a fair amount of economic damage to his country. She did a fair amount of economic damage to her country. The idea of privatizing public water, public roads, public utilities, what have you. She was at the forefront of this, but you know, at the root of it, though, at the core root of it is capitalism. You see, no one wants to discuss that. No one wants to discuss that. She gave the UK far right a license to bludgeon, a license to do grievous bodily harm, a license to be racist. I will never forget her for one thing and one thing only. I mean, the Falklands thing, you know, it is what it is, yeah? But I will never forget her for saying, now I forgot what year this was and what speech it was, even though I've written about it, where she said, the British people are tired, and she pounded the podium. She goes, we are tired of being swamped by those of an alien culture. That same week, far-right, neo-Nazi skinheads, British movement skinheads, National Front skinheads, not traditional skinheads, but these racist bastards, you know, who listen to Screwdriver, and, you know, have to be reminded that, you know, Screwdriver doesn't exist anymore. Ian Stewart is not here any longer. Hitler's dead too. You know what I'm saying? It's over. The whole white power thing is over. You know, if Britain wanted to stay white, Britain should have stayed home. I mean, that's the bottom line with that. Really. Really. I mean, if you're really going to continue with this, and it's the same thing I say to, you know, anyone from who has origin in Europe. If you don't want to have to be around, if you don't want to be around people of color, look at your own history. There's a reason. You know, you had absolutely no problem putting, you know, cathedrals in Algeria, all throughout South America, right? you know, all throughout Vietnam, you know, Indochina, right? You know, it had no problem imposing your culture on people, but when they want to put a minaret, as they like to put it in France, right? And when you want to put a minaret somewhere in Europe, well, you know, everybody starts to have diarrhea. So, you know, it's, you know, I mean, look, I'm not trying to say, you know, in any way, shape, or form, even though that's being said today, that Margaret Thatcher was the embodiment of all of that. I mean, she wasn't the only one. I mean, it's been leaked here. You have all of these offshore accounts, you know, from various people of various nationalities and ethnicities from all about the, you know, the bubble here. So it's that doesn't make any sense to me to narrow it down to her. But as far as you know, British citizens and Australians and Kiwis who want to continue to talk about, you know, Queen and flag and what have you, well, you know, I suppose for them this is a major milestone, right? You know, there would never be that era again, and let's pray that there never is another era like that in terms of labor, in terms of social just intolerance and the whole nonsense about living in the past. I mean, respect the past, but don't live in the past. I mean, if you listen to Adam Curtis at the BBC, and why shouldn't we listen to him, you know? You know, she was on and on about Churchill. People who worked with her that said she was on and on about Churchill. It was an obsession. It was an obsession. And when you look at her and Reagan, for that matter, you know, you have to ask yourself. It's like, you know, why do we allow ourselves to be controlled by these people? Why do we allow ourselves to be controlled by these people? And, you know, in terms of Reagan, he could have, you know, you have Thatcher with her statement. Reagan started his presidential run in the same town where those young people, was it Philadelphia, Mississippi? Not Philadelphia in the state of Pennsylvania. I'm talking about Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the, well, and I'm going to put it the way that they say it, but then we're going to talk about it. Goodman, Swearingen, and Cheney. Cheney was the brother, but he's the last one on that list. They were traveling with him. You dig? I'm just saying, you know, even Swearingen's wife said this. She's like, if my husband wasn't white, you wouldn't even be, you know, paying any attention to what the hell just went down here. It wasn't for the fact that Goodman's family was connected to Lyndon Johnson's political machine. Nobody probably would have gave a damn. No one probably would have gave a damn. They would just been, you know, one Negro and two Jews that would have been missing. And when you go south of the Mason-Dixon line, they would just say it was been one nigger and two kikes that would have been missing. And if you listen to the, and if you look at the newscasts of the time and the radio reports of the time, when they asked people in that town and all throughout the south how they felt about these three men being missing, you know, going missing, coming up missing, right, gone missing. You know, because that, like, you know, the fiscal cliff and Main Street and weapons of mass destruction and all these other cold terms that you get, you know, that was the thing about gone missing for a while. You don't hear that anymore either. It just came and it went. You know, it just came and like a breeze it went. Nobody thinks about that anymore. Nobody gives a damn anymore, you know. We have a mass shooting here, an event or an incident by gun, and, you know, no problem. It's the new normal. It's the new normal. So, you know, why, you know, give a damn that Margaret Thatcher has passed? I mean, it's a shame, you know, and it should be recognized when anyone who has impacted the flow of the planet has passed. But in the case of Margaret Thatcher, it's like, you know, what does one to say? There's nothing positive to say about her. You know, unless you lived in the same delusional world that she lived in, you know, empirical Britain, of a Churchill Britain. You know, because remember, Churchill was a big believer in the Anglo-Saxon race. This was something that he and the American politician Henry Wallace used to quarrel about. Because Henry Wallace was the only person in the American government to stand up to him about this type of racism. But, you know, let's not forget, too, that Lucky Lindy, Charles Lindbergh, with his multiple wives and what have you, you know, he was out here, you know, talking about the sanctity of the Anglo-Saxon race as well. Nobody really said anything about that. Not until the, you know, the U.S. got into the war, then all of a sudden, you know, they didn't like her. But, you know, the Bush family, Lindbergh, Henry Ford, ITT, Chase National at that time, Bank. You know, I mean, there were many, you know, financial concerns, many personal concerns here. There were plenty of people, or, you know, a lot of blue-collar people who said they would rather deal with Hitler than deal with, you know, like having black people or natives or Mexicans or Asians, you know, living next door to them. You know, this is doing what, you know, I mean, Professor Noam Chomsky has discussed this. You know this. I know this. You know, I mean, Puerto Ricans don't have a say in a goddamn thing, right? So, you know, so who gives a goddamn? So, yeah, so Margaret Thatcher has passed. And it is what it is. But, you know, speaking of Margaret Thatcher, you have to speak about women, right? And I mean, Simone de Beauvoir, I know, would have something to say about this. But the protests that are going on with Femin, the European-based feminist organization, well, they've stirred up a hornet's nest because by, you know, very colonially saying that they speak for all women living in Arab and Islamic cultures or societies, they really shouldn't have done that, especially with the idea about nudity. It just didn't work. They didn't consult anyone. The same thing has come up between European American feminists from the National Organization for Women, when they were pretty much imposing their cultural standards on feminists in India and feminists in the Philippines, like the Gabriela Network. You know, I used to be involved with the Gabriela Network to a peripheral degree, because it is a women's organization, but I was in a supportive role. And they made it very clear to me as a journalist that they were very agitated with the European feminists that came to work with them, because they always insisted that the only feminism that means anything is American feminism. And in the case of Femin, they made it very clear in their statements and in their actions and in their protests and in their manifestos that they are advocating a Western European feminist ideal, and that they want to basically introduce this into Islamic societies, Islamic / Arabic societies, because there is a difference. Arabs are a people. Islam is a religion. There is a difference. Anybody that tells you something else, well, you need to look at them up and down very slowly, smile as you nod, nod knowingly, and just walk away, because you're dealing with somebody that is an extremist. Just walk away. You know, that's like saying that Christianity and European is the same thing. Is it? Tell that to somebody from South America. Hey, try telling that to a Filipino who's Catholic, which is just about every Filipino. No, so, you know, you guys talk a whole lot of non-race thing. You know, live up to it. Okay, please stick around. We're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to have an audio editorial from our UK bureau chief, Selin Kay, editor of the Rise, Revolt and Resist news blog. And she has something to say about Femin. So I advise everyone to take a listen, male, female, and otherwise. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Talk radio for intelligent aboriginals. Please stay tuned.
In the Protestant religion, we are taught that when a person dies, you should celebrate their death because they are leaving a sinful world. Woman slaughter. It doesn't hurt as much now. The thought of you dead doesn't rip at my innards, leaves no holes to suck rage. Now thoughts of the four daughters of Buster Cooks, children, survivors of Texas hell, survivors of soul-searing poverty, survivors of small-town mentality, survivors, now three, doesn't hurt as much now. One, an act. I used to be fearful of phone calls in the night, never in the day. Death, like the vampire, fears the sun, never in the day. Hello, Patty. Hey, big sister, what's happening? How's the kids? Patty, Jonesy shot Shirley. She didn't make it. Hello, hello, Death. Don't you know it's daytime? The sun is much too bright today. Hello, hello, Death. You made a mistake. Came here too soon again. 5 months, Death. My sisters and I just met in celebration of you. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and buried him. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and took care of his widow. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and shook hands with his friends. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and picked the ripe flowers. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, walked tall and celebrated you. We came, his four strong daughters, and notified insurance companies, arranged Social Security payments, gathered the sum of his life. We must be strong for Mother. She was the third daughter of Buster Cooks. I am the fourth, and in his death, we met. The 4 years that separated us, gone, and we talked. She would divorce the quiet man, go back to school, begin again. Together, we would be strong and take care of Buster's widow. The poet returned to the family. The fourth daughter came home. Hello, hello, Death. What's this you say to me? Now there are three? We came, the three sisters of Shirley Jones, and took care of her mother. We picked the right flowers, contacted insurance companies, arranged Social Security payments, and cremated her. We came, the three sisters of Shirley Jones. We were not strong. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. 2. Justice. There was a quiet man. He married a quiet wife. Together, they lived a quiet life. Not so, not so, her sisters said. The truth comes out as she lies dead. He beat her. He accused her of awful things, and he beat her. One day, she left. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. She went to her sister's house. She, too, was a woman alone. The quiet man came and beat her. Both women were afraid. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. The four strong daughters of Buster Cooks came to bury him. The third one carried a gun. Why do you have a gun? For protection, just in case. Can you shoot it? Yes, I have learned well. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman alone, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. Lady, there's nothing we can do until he tries to hurt you. Go to the judge and he will decree that your husband leaves you be. She found an apartment with a friend. She would begin a new life again. In a lockery, divorce degree in hand, the end of the quiet man. He came to her home and he beat her. Both women were afraid. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman alone and I am afraid. My ex-husband means to kill me. Fear not, lady, he will be sought. It was too late when he was caught. One day, a quiet man shot his quiet wife 3 times in the back. He shot her friend as well. His wife died. The three sisters of Shirley Jones came to cremate her. They were not strong. 3. Somebody's trial. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. I was not at the trial. I was not needed to testify. She slept with other men, he said. No, said her friends. No, said her sisters. That is a lie. She was black. You're white. Why were you there? We were friends, she said. I was helping her move the furniture. The divorce court had given it to her. Were you alone, they asked. No, 2 men came with us. They were gone with the load. She slept with women, he said. No, said her sisters. No, said her friends. We were only friends. That is a lie. You live with this woman? Yes, said her friend. You slept in the same bed? Yes, said her friend. Were you lovers? No, said her friend. But you slept in the same bed? Yes, said her friend. What should be done with this man? Is it a murder of first degree? No, said the men. It is a crime of passion. He was angry. Is it a murder of second degree? Yes, said the men. But we will not call it that. we must think of his record. We will call it manslaughter. The sentence is the same. What will we do with this man? His boss, a white man, came. This is a quiet black man, he said. He works well for me. The men sent the quiet black man to jail. He went to work in the day. He went to jail and slept at night. In 1 year, he went home. 4. Woman slaughter. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. Sister, I do not understand. I rage and do not understand. In Texas, he would be freed. One black kills another, one less black for Texas. But this is not Texas. This is California, the city of angels. Was his crime so slight? George Jackson served years for robbery. Eldridge Cleaver served years for rape. I know of a man in Texas who is serving 40 years for possession of marijuana. Was his crime so slight? What was his crime? He only killed his wife, but a divorce, I say, not final, they say. Her things were his, including her life. Men cannot rape their wives. Men cannot kill their wives. They passion them to death. The three sisters of Shirley Jones came and cremated her, and they were not strong. Hear me now. It is almost 3 years, and I am again strong. I have gained many sisters. And if one is beaten, or raped, or killed, I will not come in mourning black. I will not pick the right flowers. I will not celebrate her death. And it will matter not if she's black or white, if she loves women or men. I will come with my many sisters and decorate the streets with the innards of those brothers in woman slaughter. No more can I dull my rage in alcohol and deference to men's courts. I will come to my sisters, not dutiful. I will come strong.
Nous avions décidé que nous ferions la vie ensemble, mais pas du tout, en effet, ça n'a jamais été question, il n'a jamais été question de le faire sous la forme d'un mariage. Personnellement, j'en avais pas grande envie, mais je savais surtout qu'il en avait encore beaucoup moins envie, parce que déjà, d'être professeur, d'avoir un censeur, etc., ça ne lui plaisait pas, et d'être un homme marié, ça lui aurait plu encore moins, et comme il n'était pas question d'avoir des enfants, parce que pour moi, ça ne se posait pas, non pas que ça ne soit pas posé, peut-être quand j'avais 18 ou 19 ans, quand j'envisageais un mariage bourgeois, j'avais pas de répugnance, a priori, à avoir des enfants. Mais dans le genre de vie que je comptais mener, où il fallait que je gagne ma vie d'une part et je voulais écrire d'autre part, il n'y avait pas de place pour les enfants.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Get ready, that's what it's all about.
If you're curious or confused, get information or a pamphlet at most pharmacies or a health clinic. If you need help, see a doctor.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
This is Hayley Mills. We're all familiar with the issues. We all know that we should speak out, that we should take some responsibility for the disastrous decisions and actions made and taken in our name by the leaders of the United States of America and the United Kingdom. Ask your Congress member for the appropriate investigation into the activities of the current administration. Thank you.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Tansetoja kakioni wakuma kantik. Winston Wataninia, Miksuachi, Saskatchewan, Ocean.
I am Winston Watini. I am from Saskatchewan. Knowledge is power. We must gather knowledge to protect our children, our culture, our future. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Teach others what you have learned. Together, we can make a difference.
This is APNS Public Radio. The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
You are listening to an editorial dispatch from Aboriginal Press News Service UK Bureau Chief, Celine Kay, on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
So for the past week, Muslim women have been outraged in response to the topless jihad day released by Femen for the 4th of April. And it's a solidarity strike, I guess, in support of Amina Tyler, a Tunisian Femen feminist who, you know, took a picture of herself with various slogans written on her bare breasts, and when the Tunisian when a couple of powerful men who use religion to dictate their patriarchy begin to kind of issue all sorts of rulings about her and how, you know, she should be punished or whatever, and you know, of course this is it's condemnable, and you know it must be condemned, of course, but the whole issue here is the concept of Femen declaring a topless jihad day. And I just want to ask, when did Femen become the leader of women's struggle? Who appointed them? Who said, yes, we want you to represent us across the globe? And I just think it's quite ridiculous as to how this is possible. You know, I have always disagreed with Femen, to put it simply. The concept of having to walk out into the streets bare-breasted to draw attention, especially media attention, misses the point. It identifies that it is the only way the media will pay attention to women performing for the male gaze, the man's interest. You know, nobody looks at Femen, especially men, and turns around to their friend and says, hey guys, women are being oppressed, we must do something. No, it's, you know, it's actually, hey, look, boobs, you know. Femen have reduced feminism to issues of nudity, that for some reason, the barer your flesh, the more free you are. I mean, I originally have issues with the feminist rhetoric out there in general, as feminism has far too many branches and is often advocated by the Western woman to tell non-Westerners how oppressed they are. Although there are some non-white women who equally project the same rhetoric, but these women are often those who live in the West and have, you know, have been colonized mentally. And we also need to put that into context, because a lot of people are saying, well, Amina Tyler, she's a female feminist. And I think that you need to understand the context behind Tunisia. You know, it's you know, a North African country that has been colonized for years by the French, you know, and, you know, it's a very sensitive political climate at the moment with the revolution and the fact that they haven't been able to find stability still with the assassination of the opposition and so forth. So it has been a very tricky time, and so we need to understand the view of the public as well, the mentality of the public. And so for that reason, you know, Amina doesn't represent Tunisian women. You know, I think we need to also understand that. But at the same time, make no mistake that I believe that if a woman wants to be topless in the street, I will, you know, whether I disagree or agree with it, I will stand by her choice to be able to do so without a man's approval. Same for a woman, if she chooses to wear the burqa, whether I disagree or agree with it, I will stand by her choice to do so, because the whole world is telling women what to do, including women, and this needs to stop. It has become a disgusting trend. It is patriarchal in itself. I mean, the whole world is hostile towards women, and this is something that needs to stop. And Femen is no better than old white guys telling women what to do. Essentially, they are the products of their fathers and of their brothers. So, I mean, I'm going to read out an extract from their about section on their website. Just two to three points, bullet points. So it says, we recognize the European values of freedom, equality, and comprehensive development of a person, irrespective of the gender. Second point, we build up a national image of femininity, maternity, and beauty based on the Euro-Atlantic women's movement experience. And third point, we plan to become the biggest and most influential feminist movement in Europe. Now, European values of freedom, equality, and development of a person. This here is racist. It holds white superiority. By giving such values of freedom and equality a geographic attribution, which is the West, which the geographic location contains all non-white states, all post-colonial empires, what are they saying about the rest of the world? That they fail to recognize any freedom, any free will, any equality in South America, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa? And why is that? Because they're not European? Therefore, they lack any understanding and insight what civilizations are, what freedom is, what democracy is, and that these lovely white folk have it all. Now, Muslim women, of course, are from all over the world, are outraged, and they're making a racket about you know, Femen's latest racist, orientalist, and colonialist topless jihad day. And so they should. There's actually a photo which I could not believe. where there is a white woman who's wearing a towel turban, a drawn-on monobrow, a fake paper beard with her hands outstretched upwards whilst kneeling on the floor, as Muslims do when they pray to God. Now, first of all, a towel turban? I mean, really? A towel turban? The beard, the monobrow, the pose, they're not just mockery, they're not just racist, but they're reinforcements of Orientalist stereotypes. What Femin is doing is reinforcing oppression on non-white women. That is what Femin is doing. I mean, should we expect Femin to paint themselves black whilst wearing Afro wigs to highlight rape in the Congo? The whole idea of women's liberation is her freedom to make her own choices about her own body, her own desires, without being shaped by men's approval. Femin actually has no point whatsoever. Apart from being white supremacist women taking their tops off, what are they questioning? Last year, Femin's leader, Inna Shevchenko, said better naked than a burqa, and that women's bodies are indicators of women's freedom. Now, to suggest that the barer your flesh, the more free you are, is foolish, and I'm not going to even go into why it's quite self-explanatory. To dictate to women of colour, to dictate to women that are not white, how they should be according to their values, which, I mean, who told these European women that these values are white? That these values are European? You know, who told them that? And I'm pretty sure it is the white supremacist patriarchal kind of environment. And there's a problem with feminism anyway, in terms of it's always advocated by the white woman, and post-colonial feminism is barely there to talk about. This is Céline Cara, editor of Rise, Resist and Revolt, reporting for Aboriginal Press News Service Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, healthcare, including reproductive health, was women's business and respected as such. Reclaim your healthcare choices by keeping yourself informed and sharing information with your relatives. Inform yourself about Plan B, known as the morning after pill. Plan B will protect you from becoming pregnant after a sexual assault or unprotected sex if taken within 72 hours. Make sure your local Indian Health Service facility carries Plan B. It does not require a prescription and should be provided upon request. It's your right. For more information, call your local healthcare facility. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and First Voices Indigenous Radio.org.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For men in hip hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable. You know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported. You know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today, and said what he said. You know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year or whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African American.
Yeah, I was driving in today and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment into its eighth year now. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio. Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Now that America has a black president, is this proof that racism is a thing of the past?
Well, I think white men were 100% of the people that wrote the Constitution, 100% of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, 100% of the people who died at Gettysburg and Vicksburg, probably close to 100% of the people who died at Normandy. This has been a country built basically by white folks in this country who were 90% of the entire nation. I think they ought to do. They ought to defend the legitimate rights of white working class folks who are the victims of discrimination.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Media. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. I'm Michael Sleesman, Managing Director and Research Scholar at the Center. In this edition of the Bioethics Podcast, we bring you a paper presentation by CBHD fellow Gregory W. Rutecki, MD, that originally was delivered as a parallel paper session at CBHD's 2009 summer conference, Global Bioethics: Emerging Challenges Facing Human Dignity. The presentation is entitled Forced Sterilization of Native Americans: Late 20th Century Physician Cooperation with National Eugenic Policies.
Hello, everyone. This will be a little different. I want to be somewhat informal, though the topic seems very formal. I'm reading about some important bioethical aspects of Native American culture at the interface with the United States government, more importantly with physicians. And I'll admit right up front, I am not an expert in history of Native Americans. My wife and I were in a small group Bible study, and one of the members was getting her master's degree in U.S. history, and she had a particular interest in Native American culture. So I found out very quickly that what I knew about Native American culture, I could put in a thimble with room left over. And so I had her help me read a little bit, and I became fascinated reading about Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, I think like everyone else, reading about Wounded Knee. And because I came at it with a background in bioethics, what I really learned was that I was extremely naive, both about the force of the eugenics movement in the United States, to the point that Adolf Hitler wrote letters thanking physicians in the U.S. for teaching him how to engineer the final solution. And I went on to do some collateral reading after reading Edwin Black's book, The War Against the Weak, and found out, lo and behold, that while I was in medical school, and I realized that wasn't yesterday, but in the mid-1970s, that American physicians, with impunity, were sterilizing and aborting Native American women on reservations. And so that's what this is about. I will not go over the introduction again because I ended up writing it as a paper, and the introduction is pretty much contained in the abstract you have before you, but I'd like to go over the history and then put it in conjunction with a look at the American eugenics movement, which began during the 1890s, and look at some of the physicians, and then try to argue, I don't know whether it will be persuasively or not, that in reality, many of the physicians who aborted and sterilized, whether it be Native American women, African-American women, or Latinos, were fully consistent with behavior that had been modeled the generation preceding. And I think the most shocking part for me was it was as if Nuremberg, the Geneva Convention, all the talk fresh in their minds about the Holocaust had absolutely no impact whatsoever on the philosophical underpinnings of a significant number of American physicians. This all started when a woman, Native American woman, came in to see a physician who, not by chance, I think it was destined to be that way, a physician named Connie Pinkerton Urey, who also was Native American. And the young lady was about 24 years old, and her chief complaint was that she wanted a uterine transplant. She caught the physician totally off guard because there was no idea whatsoever, a concept of uterine transplantation. When she was asked why, in Native American culture, it's important to bear children, and she underwent a total abdominal hysterectomy at age 20 for very unconvincing reasons. And so Pinkerton Urey started to look into this. Was this the tip of an iceberg? Was this a bizarre occurrence on one single reservation? And not long afterward, two other women, both again in their 20s, went in for appendectomies on reservations and received a, quote, incidental tubal ligation prior to having any children. Connie Pinkerton Urey decided to pursue it, and the U.S. government decided to embarrass her, kind of saying that this was just a very biased approach by a Native American physician to make a mountain out of a molehill. And so what they did for her was they decided, forced by a senator in South Dakota who had a heart for the Native American population, November 6, 1976, the government accounting office decided, okay, there are 12 Indian Health Service areas that are covered. We're going to pacify Dr. Pinkerton Urey, and we're going to look at four of those areas to see, to prove that her allegations that there's forced sterilizations and abortions on reservations never took place. So they looked at the records of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Aberdeen, South Dakota, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and Phoenix, Arizona, and found out that between 1973, again, the timing just is scary. You'd think I'd be saying 1873, but it's 1973 and 1976, that at least, and we're going to go through independent reporting, so there were some independent investigations at the same time, there were 3,406 sterilizations performed that were reported. Now, that's interesting because if you look at a per capita, I mean, there are not a lot of Native Americans left even in America. That would be the equivalent of sterilizing 452,000 non-Native American women within the same time frame, which was 3 years, 1973 to 1976. And what was bothersome about the facts in the case was that if you looked at the Albuquerque, New Mexico situation, and we'll talk a little bit about how many Indian Health Service doctors there were, they did not have enough doctors to perform any surgeries, much less sterilization and abortion. So they contracted out at full price to the private community to physicians to perform the sterilizations and abortions for them. And none of those statistics were included in the final tally, which means that the government accounting office's report was probably a gross underestimate of the number of Native American women who were both aborted and sterilized. What the government also admitted at the time, but very quietly, was that physicians who were contracted out for sterilizations in Albuquerque, New Mexico, did not have to follow any government rules, laws regarding informed consent. And so, as we'll find out later, there was active coercion. Women were told that the children they had would be taken away from them if they did not consent to sterilization. So it looked like there needed to be some independent review since the government was only going to look at 4 out of 12 reservations. And the best study I found was actually done by a public health group. And what they did, they went to a single Navajo reservation and looked at figures from 1972 to 1978 to see indeed if Connie Pinkerton Urey was seeing a tip of the iceberg. And they found out, lo and behold, we had a crisis on our hands. There was a 130% increase in the number of abortions over that period of time. So in number, the ratio of abortions per 1,000 deliveries on that reservation, again from 1972 to 1978, increased from 34 to 77. In the same study, they also demonstrated that in the interval between 1972 and 1978, sterilization procedures, first was abortion, now sterilization procedures, increased from 15.1 to 30.7% of all female surgeries performed. So rather than embarrass Dr. Urey, who had met occasional patients who had said they'd been sterilized without consent, in fact, some of these women were told that it was a temporary procedure and it could be reversed later, independent investigations additional to the government accounting office demonstrated that this was a real serious problem that warranted investigation. I'll go to the end of some of the story right off the bat. It never made court. Two or three Cheyenne women in Wyoming who were going to testify and try to get this to the Supreme Court were paid off by the government, and so none of the physicians' names can be found. I've done a fairly extensive literature search, including public health journals just applying to Native American health, and I cannot find the name of a single physician who was complicit in this behavior, either as a member of the Indian Health Service or as a private contracted physician. What bothered me even more was to look and ask a couple fundamental questions after I saw that data. Was this behavior just a continuation of eugenic policy, which was fairly explicitly commented upon by Edwin Black in his book? Was it some sort of aberration? Was someone being paid to do something that where greed transcended philosophy? And what I found out was a background that shocked me, and again, I apologize for my naivete. Many of you probably knew this long before I told you. I started to look at some physicians in the United States who formed the backbone of eugenic policy that later was imitated in great degree with the Third Reich in their final solution. And look at some of the dates here. In Kansas, in the 1890s, there was a physician named F. Hoyt Pilcher. He surgically sterilized 58, quotes, feeble-minded children as early as the 1890s. And I think many of you are familiar as this unfolds over the next generation of the quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, two generations of imbeciles are enough. It's a privilege to bear children. And so it became acceptable philosophy to sterilize those who were supposedly going to have less than sterling children. Another one named Harry Clay Sharp, he graduated from medical school in 1893. He castrated individuals and institutions who masturbated. Albert John Ochsner advocated compulsory sterilization of criminals, and this was even before the turn of the 20th century. And interesting enough, his philosophy was not only published, but enthusiastically published in a journal that still has a wide readership today, the Journal of the American Medical Association. And so background was that the late 19th and early 20th century for our country, but also more importantly for the American physicians, would become a harbinger of worse things yet to come. And one of the more amazing ones, and I thought for a very long time that some of the Nazi behaviors in the Holocaust during World War II were learned from Turkish physicians who, during the original genocide, in fact, the New York Times called that the first Holocaust. During that genocide, the Armenian physicians had managed to make a kind of archetype gas chamber, which obviously the German physicians at the time saw, which might have informed German physicians later. But in reality, this is an American physician in 1899 by the name of W. Duncan McKim. He actually wanted to provide a pragmatic, unfortunately pragmatic and medical way to accomplish his end of executing, in quotes, undesirables. And so he observed, consistent with what then became a fairly predominant eugenic frame, that heredity, in quotes, is the fundamental cause of human wretchedness. The surest, the most humane means for preventing reproduction among those that we deem unworthy of the high privilege of reproduction is a gentle, painless death. And he actually came up with a gas chamber that used carbonic acid to kill what he had hoped to be humans that were deemed undesirable. At that time and shortly thereafter, it was really interesting to read a list of people who were explicitly and actively in favor of eugenic sterilization and quite possibly eugenic euthanasia. And it includes a who's who of both the intelligentsia and the wealthy, inclusive of Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, Oliver Wendell Holmes of the infamous quote I alluded to earlier. And most of the research, most of the publications were funded very liberally, not by the NIH, but by both the Rockefeller and the Carnegie foundations at that time. So I asked myself, did this philosophy survive World War II? And I wanted to see if I could find proof in my investigation that the physicians active in the eugenic movement on Indian reservations as late as the 1970s, were they just resurfacing a philosophy, despite the fact that I thought Nuremberg, Geneva, and a lot of other important, very public trials had ended that unfortunate phase of our fallen human nature. Interestingly enough, I found information right away that indeed World War II wasn't the end. John D. Rockefeller, he got to name 10 members to a population council in 1952. Now it's after World War II. Of the 10 members that he named to his council, 6 had been explicitly active in the eugenic movement of one generation earlier, and it actively preached eugenic sterilization and abortion. So let's look at the physicians in the Indian Health Service and see if we could come up with some motivators. A lot of information available about what they were paid, how difficult the job was to obtain. To try to get an idea, were they motivated at all by finances? Were they motivated by philosophy? Were they motivated by the government? New recruits to the Indian Health Service in the early 1970s, the era under scrutiny, made only between $17,000 to $20,000 per year. There were no incentives whatsoever. So if they said, I sterilize or I abort because I get a bonus, that did not occur. They worked on average a 60-hour work week, and I expect at $17,000 a year with a 60-hour work week, that they were not looking for extra work. And so I think that I had a suspicion at that point in time that the motivation related to a continuation of eugenic philosophy that had begun early in the 20th century. Interestingly enough, a number of questionnaires were done at that time trying to find out what physicians in the United States of the 1950s and 60s thought about eugenic procedures. And what people found out was that if you asked the average physician, let's take 1972, about sterilization, 6% would answer a questionnaire saying that they would recommend sterilization as an option for a white woman who could pay for the surgery. However, that number increased to 14% if the woman in question was a welfare mother with three or more children. When asked later on what was the best method of birth control, 97% said that sterilization was a very acceptable form of birth control. So it seems like the physicians in the 1970s, Indian Health Service and not, inhabited an ethos that was thought was completely consistent with serving the country, serving society at large by sterilizing those that they thought were undesirable. Here's a quote from a Dr. Curtis Wood right around the same time. It's interesting. The name of his association is the Association for Voluntary Sterilization, and I apologize for the misnomer. But this is his quote as head of that agency. After 30 years of delivering babies, I found that if the doctor does a proper job of offering sterilization to these women on welfare, a high percentage of them would accept it. I have found after 3 to 4 minutes of talking with them, they will accept it. Then there was a quote from a lady who I think had phenomenal insight by the name of Barbara Caress. And she studied the culture at that time and said that, quotes, sterilization abuse is both systematic and widespread. It stems from a combination of factors, teaching and research, fee-for-service systems, which we'll talk about in just a second with the contract model of medicine. It is the most widespread example of medicine as an instrument of social control. Since 1970, the figures show an almost threefold increase in the incidence of female sterilization. Now, she's presenting this as a general phenomenon, not necessarily focused solely on the Native American population. 192,000 women sterilized in 1970 to 548,000 in 1974. And she then tries to place blame. Many young gynecologists in training have united their professional needs for training and their political ideas. And she said another reason for an increase in operations is greed. And then she goes on to say between 1967 and 1973, federal support for family planning services increased more than 1,300%. If the physician did the sterilization and sent the bill, he or she would be paid. And so she said the line between voluntary and involuntary sterilization becomes thinner all the time. So what I did after that was say, well, let's try a dichotomy possibly for physicians and say that the physicians in the Indian Health Service obviously had to be motivated by philosophy because they sure weren't motivated by money. What about the physicians, specifically in Albuquerque, who were contracted for the patients that they saw? I really think if we look at William Mays, and I still think it's a wonderful way to conceptualize medical practice as, is it philanthropy? Is it contract? Is it covenant or code? It was very clear to see that it surely was not philanthropy. That was a very easy argument to sustain. But I think what happened was we were seeing the first generation of physicians in America that would be paid by Uncle Sam without capitation, without question, every time by contract that they performed only a surgical procedure. And they were unrestrained at the time by informed consent. When they were investigated, there were three terrible informed consent documents. But when any effort was made legally or by Congress. There was a specific representative who tried to pursue this. The government absolved them because they said they did not need to follow informed consent. It was quid pro quo. You do a sterilization, you perform an abortion, you're paid for that. So it struck me, and I drew some conclusions that may be some stretches, but it worries me today. Right now, I can say that the sterilizations on reservations had stopped, thanks to Representative James Zaborczyk, a very interesting man at the time, because he understood sectarian conflict and genocide. His family had immigrated from Lebanon. He had stopped the coercion by saying no longer can the U.S. government take Indian children when Native American parents refused to consent to sterilization or abortion or any other type of abnormality. He stopped that from happening. It ended. The last I can find in the United States is 1979, California. The leader in the United States for forced sterilizations and abortions had finally stopped. It appears today, if we look at the Dartmouth Atlas and a number of other places, the physicians, and I miss the right group to talk about fallen nature with, physicians have as fallen a nature as anyone else. And what happens is when they are allowed to get paid for performing a procedure, technique, only technique outside of ethics, especially with declining reimbursements, the temptation is too much to pass up. And so I think that with a lot of the payment models today are strictly driven by contract, and I know many saw it. I got to write a commentary on peer review in Christian Medical and Dental Society newsletter. It was an actual case of a physician on call at night in a state that has 28% level reimbursement for cardiologic procedures, who obviously is being reimbursed less, who dilated a lady's coronary arteries in her 80s with a 30% lesion. He sends in a bill, he's going to get paid. And so now he's got a lady in her 80s who's on Plavix, clopidogrel, and is going to be at risk for bleeding with what's left of her duration of life. And so contract medicine bothers me, and I think that this was one of the first examples, particularly in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of where quid pro quo payment divorced technique, the term that Nigel Cameron uses frequently, divorce technique from any ethical constraints on the performance of the procedure.
Okay, thank you.
People that don't understand Jewish live in the Canaanites. Yemenites. I'll interpret for you, honey. I'll interpret. There's only two words you have to know anyway in the English language, and that's gelt and schmuck. Because if a man has no gelt, he is. He is. Yeah, I found out Sammy Davis, my cousin. Yeah. On my mother-in-law's side. You think you got trouble? There's a guy that's Jewish, married a Gentile girl, and can't even check in the Kenilworth. He got Jewish, right, boy?
This is Radio Intelligente Rindigina.